registered a surge in heat-related deaths, 486 in British Columbia and dozens more south of the border in the United States. Roads buckled as asphalt expanded. At least one city suffered power cuts. The psychological, political and economic impacts are harder to quantify, but for many, along with the horror, came a sense of bewilderment that these northern territories were hotter than West Asia. David Phillips, the Canadian government's senior climatologist, summed it up in an interview with CTV. He said, "I mean, it's just not something that seems Canadian. More people in more countries are feeling that their weather belongs to another part of the world. According to the Weather Prediction Center, across the border in Washington state, the maximum heat measured at Olympia and Quillayute was 6 degrees Celsius higher than the previous all-time record. Further down in Oregon, the town of Salem hit 47 degrees Celsius, smashing the previous record by 9 degrees Celsius. Several areas of California and Idaho also saw new highs. The previous week, Northern Europe and Russia also sweltered in an unprecedented heat bubble. June records were broken in Moscow, 34.8 degrees Celsius. In Helsinki, Finland, 31.7 degrees Celsius. In Belarus, 35.7 degrees Celsius, and in Estonia, 34.6 degrees Celsius. Further east in Siberia experienced an early heat wave that helped to reduce the amount of sea ice in the Laptev Sea to a record low for the time of the year. The town of Oymyakon, Russia, widely considered to be the coldest inhabited place on Earth, was hotter, 31.6 degrees Celsius, than it has ever been in June. This followed a staggeringly protracted hot spell in Siberia last year that lasted several months. Carlo Buontempo, director of the Copernicus Climate Change Service, said there was a clear human fingerprint on this very freakish event. He said without emissions from cars, farms and industry, the record temperatures in the western North Americas was to be expected only once in 10,000 years. But the probability rises along with the levels of the greenhouse gas emissions. Carlo Buontempo said, "In the present day climate, getting an extremely hot June is common and is likely to occur twice in three decades." However, an analysis from many computer models suggests that by the end of the century, these extreme temperatures are more likely than not. Human influence is estimated to have increased the likelihood of a new record several thousand times. Rising temperatures can be seen across the world, even in West Asia. Temperatures of 50 degrees Celsius plus were once outliers, but parts of Pakistan, India, Australia, the United States and Canada are now regularly approaching or passing that mark. But the intensity of the heat in the Northwest Americas this year and Siberia last year has taken many scientists by surprise and suggested extra factors may be involved in northern latitudes. One theory is that the recent temperature spike might have been caused not just by global heating, but by slowing weather systems that get stuck in one place for an extended period of time, which gives them time to intensify and cause more damage. This was an important factor in the devastation in Texas caused by Hurricane Harvey in 2018, which simply sat above Houston for several days rather than blowing inland and weakening. Blocked high-pressure fronts were also blamed for the blistering heat wave in Europe in 2019. Experts at the Potsdam Institute in Germany and elsewhere believe the rapid heating of the Arctic and decline of sea ice is making the jet stream wiggle in large meandering patterns, so-called Rossby resonance waves, trapping high and low pressure weather systems in one location for a longer period of time. The theory remains contested, but Michael Mann, director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University, said recent unexpected fierce heat at Lytton in British Columbia, Canada, and elsewhere should prompt climatologists to consider additional impacts of human activity. He wrote in an email, "We should take this event very seriously," adding, "You warm up the planet, you're going to see an increased incidence of extreme heat." Climate models capture this effect very well and predict large increases in heat extremes. But there is something else going on with this heat wave, and indeed with many of the very persistent weather extremes we've seen in recent years in the United States, in Europe, in Asia, and elsewhere, where the models aren't quite capturing the impact of climate change. Regardless of which interactions are to blame, scientists are agreed that the simplest way to reduce the risk of further temperature jolts is to cut fossil fuel emissions and halt deforestation. Frederica Otto, Associate Director of the Environmental Change Institute at the University of Oxford in England, said, "It appears that this heat wave is still a rare phenomena in the current climate, but whether it stays that way depends on our decisions today." He added, "If the world does not rapidly eliminate fossil fuel use and other sources of greenhouse gas emissions, like deforestation, global temperatures will continue to rise, and deadly heat waves such as these will become even more common."
Economic divide.
The G7 is supposed to lead the world. After all, it is composed of the seven richest countries. Yet their policies are proving otherwise. From the proposed tax law to their summit recently, which demonized China on a host of issues. Hello and welcome. I'm Kavitawe. Coming up in today's program, the G7 summit slamming China's economic prowess. Containing China to be the goal. But they also say they welcome competition. What kind of welcoming is that when they sanction and restrict Chinese companies? Well, when it comes to China, it's not having it. They have countered by first saying that a small group of countries does not rule the world. China also introduced a new anti-foreign sanctions policy. Companies to be put on a blacklist. Can you guess which countries they are? And then finally, the G7 has proposed a tax reform on the world stage, a U.S. proposed global corporate tax rate for the first time. But how can the U.S. propose this when U.S. companies are not paying their fair share of taxes?
How's that? Okay, you're right. Can you hear me, everybody? Can I begin by welcoming everybody to Carbis Bay?
It's the same old same, but with different players. Finance ministers and central bankers from the G7 economic powers getting together to discuss the global economy. Some topics from the past have been the faltering global recovery, debt crises, and stability in the banking sector. Yet not much headway has been made, like in the case of world debt. If one was to ask how much debt has been accumulated over the past decade, the figures would be shocking. $281 trillion is the current world debt. Out of that, the U.S. added about $9 trillion of debt over the past decade. And this year, what appears to be a U.S. push, China has become enemy number one, along with Russia. This is while the U.S. government is incapable or unwilling to protect American citizens from its own police force. And yet, it is planning to spend hundreds of billions in tax dollars to confront China. The Innovation and Competition Act 2021 will spend $250 billion on the rivalry with China.
G7 communique was a straight attack on China, minus the military hardware. China did not deserve to be downgraded this way. Of course, China did retaliate. Now, the view held by the U.S. and China was that it represented a significant challenge to the world's democracies. It was reported that the leaders agreed the need for a common agenda in addressing China, including elements where they would stand up and counter and compete.
I think we're in a contest, not with China per se, but a context with autocrats, autocratic governments around the world, as whether or not democracies can compete with them in a rapidly changing 21st century. And I think how we act and whether we pull together as democracies is going to determine whether our grandkids look back 15 years from now and say, did they step up?
Well, China's response to this unfounded accusation stood in stark contrast to the G7 countries, in particular the U.S. It's time now to bring our first guest to the program. He is none other than Justin Stewart. He is the ambassador at Seven Investment Management, which he founded. He is also an investment manager and business commentator who has appeared on numerous TV outlets. Well, Justin, welcome. The leading world countries, which are comprised of the G7, came up with an anti-China stance. They said because China has become an economic powerhouse to rival the U.S. and possibly, of course, set to be moving into the number one economy in the world, that spot, that it's going to pose a security threat. How is it possible to actually, for them, to draw that conclusion?
It's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out now, because what you've got is a G7 group of countries who are suffering from a bout of severe insecurity. Insecurity against, well, not just China, but also Russia as well. Following, obviously, the dreadful regime that we had under President Trump, which destroyed a lot of the trust between those members.
Indeed, we can't forget that. Thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. That's Justin there. We are headed for a quick break now here on Economic Divide. And what better way to do that than to actually see some fantastic images of protests that happened during the G7 summit, which was held in UK's Cornwall, where the protesters actually devised some really creative ways to bring their message across, including a fabulous display by Greenpeace, which involved drones.
World leaders have committed to being carbon neutral by 2050. That's too late. It's like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Since the Paris summit, carbon emissions actually gone up. So, carbon emissions have gone up. I'm a grandmother. I'm desperately trying to make sure that there's a future.
Once upon a time, our world leaders gathered in Cornwall to decide our future. I hope it's not too late.
So Greenpeace is here with a very simple, clear message, which is act now to the leaders of the G7. They need to step up and actually deliver on their promises for the climate and nature emergency.
I want our leaders to do their jobs and fight for the planet. Hope comes from action, not words.
It's time now for our in-depth section. Let's dig deep into the G7 to find out its relevance and areas of focus. Now, in terms of the group itself, it's an organization of the world's seven largest so-called advanced economies. They are in no particular order. The UK, France, Canada, you have the United States, Japan, Italy, and rounding off the list, Germany. Now, notice how China and Russia are not in this grouping. Well, China has never been a member, despite having one of the largest economies in the world, soon to take over the U.S., but its low level of wealth per person means that it is not seen as an advanced economy in the way that other G7 members are. Now, Russia was thrown out of the G7 back in the year 2014, and the reason for that, well, is because of its annexation of Crimea, which is still hurting it. Russia was actually part of a grouping called the G8. And at this point, well, it has not been permitted back into the group. Now, is the G7 all that it is cracked up to be in terms of it consisting of the seven most advanced economies in the world? Although that could be up for discussion, you can't deny the hard facts. Looking at the gross domestic product for the year 2019, it comes in at 31.68% of the global economy. The G20 countries, which exclude G7, the G20 that is, they have 41.51% share of the global GDP. Note how the G7 number is going down, however, based on projections for the year 2025, coming in at, again, a projection at 28.8%, its share of the global GDP for that year. Now, the goals of this year's G7 summit in the UK is kind of similar to the previous ones. For example, looking at the coronavirus, this is not the same. Obviously, this is new. The coronavirus global recovery is something that was an area of focus, promoting free and fair trade. That's been a continuing theme. Looking at climate change, tackling that, obviously, a big priority, as they have said every year when they have the summit. And finally, one of the things, global shared values, another one that's actually been a theme of previous summits, and one that was much touted about recently is the fair taxation, which we're going to get into later. Well, here's UK's finance minister, who has spelled out the terms or the theme of and objectives of the G7 to the finance ministers of the G7 countries.
Morning. Delighted to welcome today G7 finance ministers to the UK. It's the first time we've met in person in 2 years, and I believe we can make significant progress in tackling some of the world's most pressing economic challenges. Firstly, providing support to vulnerable countries through coronavirus. Secondly, making sure that we meet our ambitions on net zero and tackling climate change. And thirdly, ensuring that the way we tax large, global, especially digital companies is fair and fit for the modern age. I'm confident we can make progress on all these fronts. Thank you.
Well, these goals are a repeat from previous summits. There's nothing new about them, except for the coronavirus pandemic, of course. Now, how close has the G7 then come to its current and to its previous goals? Well, let's take a look at, for example, climate change. This is a stark reality. The G7 nations spending more on fossil fuels than green energy. Public money committed to forms of energy in G7 countries, and it's from the year 2020 through 2021, January through March of the current year. Look at the stark reality here. They have spent $189 billion on fossil fuels, and when you compare that to clean energy, the clean energy money that they have spent, $147 billion on clean energy there. Well, let's take a look at another issue here that comes into display. Again, displaying a double standard when it comes to G7 countries. These are the top four companies out of the 20 that have contributed to the CO2 emissions. In this case, you're looking at 480 billion tons of carbon dioxide that have been emitted since 1965. The top four companies, Saudi Aramco, Chevron, Gazprom, and ExxonMobil, continuously year after year to be the top four CO2 emitters. And of course, when you take a look at these companies, well, you have basically UK and the US as major stockholders. Well, campaigners again had to voice their opposition towards the G7 countries that they are not living up to their promises.
And we're bitterly disappointed to see the lack of action that's needed. These are seven of the most powerful countries in the world. You know, what they do matters. And when they decide to do very little and look at spin instead of substance, to cook the books, to cook the planet, then that's just not good enough. So yes, we're really disappointed. They could have done a lot more and they failed.
We know in detail what is happening to our planet. And we know many of the things we need to do during this decade. We have the skills to address it in time. All we need is the global will to do so.
All right, Sir David Attenborough there. Well, another theme that the G7 boasts about tackling inequality, yet the world is still experiencing record inequality. Just in the year 2019, the world's 2,153 billionaires have more wealth than 4.6 billion people who make up 60% of the planet's population.
The message is loud and clear. We need to end the billionaire boom. This is a system which is built on the exploitation of women, girls, ordinary people, and planet Earth. This cannot continue. Obscene inequality needs to end.
Indeed. Let's take a look at another chart here. It's actually a comparative study which drives the point home when combining the world's rich, which come from the G7 countries, to their fossil fuel emissions. Yes, those two topics merged into one. Now, based on what you see over here, the richest 10% of the people produce half of the planet's individual consumption-based fossil fuel emissions. Now, you take that and then compare it to what we have here, the poorest 50%, which is roughly about 3.5 billion people. They only contribute 10%. Well, there you go. Hopefully, that drives the point home. So you have all of that on one side of the story that we explained. Then you have the recent G7 communique, which in a nutshell blasted China for, in part, its economic advancement. This is what they have said: China using economic might to bully others. Now, the U.S. also calls it competition. Now, China obviously is not going to have any of that. It has retaliated, cautioning the G7 that a small group of countries just does not rule the world. Now, another issue that the G7 recently proposed and got the nod from its members was the issue of taxation. It was a U.S. proposal that originated from the U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. But how can a country that can't manage its own companies pay taxes propose a tax plan for the entire world?
The G7 has taken significant steps this weekend to end the existing harmful dynamic.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's claim to fame.
Making commitments today that provide tremendous momentum towards achieving a robust global minimum tax at a rate of at least 15%.
She's hailed an unprecedented commitment by the G7 wealthy nations to achieve a global minimum corporate tax rate of at least 15%. Rich nations have failed for years to agree to a way to raise more taxes from large multinationals like Google, Amazon, and Facebook, which often pay little or no taxes on their income. A deal could raise tens of billions of dollars from governments at a time when government coffers are empty after the coronavirus pandemic.
We want all the digital companies, all the important digital companies that are making huge profits, to be in the scope of this digital taxation. Nobody could understand that at the end of the negotiation we could explain, well, there is a digital taxation, but you have some of the digital giants being included and some of the digital giants being included and the other one excluded.
Yet real commitments have not been made as of yet, raising the possibility that this may be yet another failed attempt to collect corporations that evade or don't pay their fair share of taxes.
We are discussing, as you know, on the proposal the United States made to have a minimum tax rate of 15% or more, and we are discussing on the question of how to better tax the digital corporates.
When it comes to the U.S., how can it expect this agreement to be a success when it can't even manage corporations within the U.S. to pay their fair share of taxes? In the most recent report, many Fortune 500 companies who were profitable had a total federal tax rate of zero or less for three consecutive years.
In this segment, both of our guests will be featured to see what they think about our hot topic of the program, and that's China's anti-sanction law. Now, this law is designed to boost Beijing's power against international pressure. It aims to protect Chinese individuals or organizations in the event that a country uses various pretexts or its laws to take discriminatory action against them. So without further ado, let's see what our guests think about this. Justin Stewart, ambassador at Seven Investment Management, rejoins us along with Craig Holman, lobbyist at Public Citizen. Okay, Justin, first over to you. Beijing accusing Western nations, especially the U.S., of suppressing China's development, lashing out at illegal and unreasonable sanctions, as I just mentioned. And then they have this Chinese law against foreign sanctions designed to boost Beijing's power against international pressure. pressure. Do you think this is going to shield China and its interests and also its companies?
Any action by government normally to try and actually fend off against international sanctions normally doesn't tend to work very well. The only way to actually manage sanctions is to actually sit down and negotiate with those countries, whether you actually like them or not.
Craig, what do you think about what our guest Justin has said there, that China actually should sit down and talk this over with China, especially when it comes to sanctions, that ultimately, you know, this is going to backfire and negotiations is the only real way of getting these countries, like the G7 countries, to get along with China?
China has just passed a law that is the most draconian response to sanctions. If the G7 actually imposes sanctions or starts phasing out Chinese investments, they came out with a very draconian law that would, first of all, ban any foreign country that did something like that from participating in the Chinese market at all. I mean, that's not how it's done these days. I mean, these days there are sanctions. You know, we'll impose a 10% fee on importing your products as a sanction. China's law says we just won't let you come in here and join our market whatsoever. And then it goes even another step further, and it penalizes not only the companies and the countries behind those types of efforts, but even the individuals, where it would threaten arrests, harassment of individuals, of companies that are targeted. Now, that is so draconian that I really don't believe China plans on carrying through with it.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to thank both Justin Stewart and Craig Holman there. Obviously, insightful statements on China and the Chinese sanctions law that they've incorporated. So at this point, it's be a good time to actually take a look at some more of those sound bites from the protesters at the G7 summit, of which after that, I'm going to be right back with our info news section. It's time now for our info news section, where we take a look at other economic news from around the world to be highlighted that we've deemed to be important. First up, we're going to take a look at a piece of news that involves inequality. In this case in point, the COVID crisis to have caused wealth inequality. Nothing new about that. We've covered that before. But what caught our attention is the fact that you have a 5.2 million increase in the world millionaires to a total of 56.1 million people. So you can see how that is increasing. And the 56.1 million people, they hold 45.8% of the world's wealth. What happened to the G7 when it comes to tackling inequality, by the way? Okay, moving on to the next item, fake reviews. Yes, this is incredible. Amazon and Google are being investigated over fake reviews. Why are they having fake reviews? Well, the reason is, it turns out that the sellers on their sites are using fake reviews to improve their star ratings. And of course, people then use that as the barometer to go and buy, for example, the products from these manufacturers or factories that make these products. And this way, they eliminate competition. Next up to China. China's poverty rate. After 8 years, they've eliminated poverty in that country. And that's really a milestone. How have they been able to do that? Well, that story is very long. Obviously, initiative from the government has a lot to do with this monumental task, but the result was that 99 million rural poor were actually raised from poverty. Again, quite a feat there, and kudos to China for that. And our final look regards U.S. sanctions. This is quite incredible. You have the United States and Israel who have renewed sanctions on Cuba. U.S. has been blasted for continuing to have sanctions on Cuba for decades. However, they are the only two to have renewed sanctions on Cuba. This is while 184 nations have condemned the American blockade of this island nation. And that, of course, is something that Cuba has lost billions of dollars in trade revenues. The issues of the world today are left to be solved by the G7 rich countries in the world. That is what the premise is. But a reality check of the state of affairs in the world today paints a very different picture.
If you just look around the world, more than 30 countries are seeing protests. People are on the streets, and what are they saying? That they're not going to accept this inequality. They're not going to live with these conditions.
The G7 is not interested in really solving the problems of the world, or else it would have done so by now. When just a handful of people have as much money as the rest of the world, problems could be solved, let alone if you take the richest seven countries to tackle that. But that is the whole point, isn't it? The rich can not only get away with it, they need to have the rest of the population be in need of them so that their superiority reigns. Don't get me wrong, these seven countries have done the world a lot of good, but the contribution has been just handouts if you look at it. They need to act now, before time runs out, especially on planet Earth. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Your questions and comments are always welcome. From Mikhail Tov, my entire team here, it's goodbye until the next program.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump returned to the campaign stage, if not the campaign trail, on Saturday, 3rd of July, with a rally in Sarasota, Florida. There are no national elections in the United States this year, but the former President Donald Trump maintains a grip on the Republican Party ahead of the 2022 midterm elections and is toying with a run for the presidency in 2024, despite gathering legal problems in New York and elsewhere. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled Donald Trump Stages Florida Rally Decrying New York Charges. Stay with us for more of Martin Pengelly's article. Former President Donald Trump returned to the campaign stage, if not the campaign trail, on Saturday, 3rd of July, with a rally in Sarasota, Florida. There are no national elections in the United States this year, but the former president maintains a grip on the Republican Party ahead of the 2022 midterm elections and is toying with the idea of a run for the presidency in 2024, despite gathering legal problems in New York and elsewhere. On Thursday, 1st of July, the Trump Organization and its chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, pleaded not guilty to criminal charges brought by the Manhattan District Attorney regarding suspected tax fraud. Donald Trump accused the prosecutors of being politically motivated, saying, "The Republican Party should not allow this to happen. It's a radical left disgrace to our country. And nobody should stand for it, not even Democrats. Republicans must fight back. This will rip our country apart." But his refusal to leave the political stage is seen by many as dangerously divisive in itself. Trailing coverage of the Sarasota event, Donald Trump told supporters it could be seen on OAN and Newsmax, two hard-right television networks. The rally was billed as a 4th of July celebration featuring fireworks and drew several thousand in a state that Donald Trump won by more than 3 percentage points in 2020. Trump lost the contest to Joe Biden by more than 7 million ballots nationally and by 306 to 232 in terms of Electoral College votes, a conclusive beating which he called a landslide when it was in his favor over Hillary Clinton in 2016, which he nonetheless claims was a result of electoral fraud. It was not, but Trump's lie dominates the Republican Party, fueling the deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol building on 6th of January, and attempts in GOP-controlled states to limit ballot access and make it easier to overturn election results. This week, Donald Trump told the Fox News host, Sean Hannity, he had decided on whether to run again in 2024, saying, "It's not that I want to run. The country needs it. We have to take care of this country. It isn't fun fighting constantly, fighting always." He also trailed a significant announcement about his efforts to protect Americans' First Amendment rights, which he said he would make at his golf course in Bedminster, New Jersey, on Wednesday. Meanwhile, according to a Reuters news agency opinion poll, 53% of Republicans believe Donald Trump won the election and blame his loss on illegal voting. A quarter of the American public think that Donald Trump actually won last November's presidential election. Earlier this week, Trump visited the U.S.-Mexico border and accused Joe Biden of neglecting national security. He held his first comeback rally last weekend in Wellington, Ohio, supporting a former White House aide's primary challenge to Anthony Gonzalez. Gonzalez was one of 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump on a charge of inciting the 6th of January attack on the Capitol building, Trump's second impeachment, a unique achievement. Donald Trump has promised to campaign against all 10 House Republicans who voted to send him to trial in the Senate. 7 Republicans there voted for his guilt, not enough to convict. In Ohio, he rehashed old lines and repeated his lie about the election, claims that Utah Senator Mitt Romney compared to professional wrestling, entertaining but not real. Many Republicans believe them, though. One attendee in Ohio, Gary Bartlett, 65-year-old and a retired manual worker at General Motors, told The Guardian he voted for Democrats until he switched to Donald Trump in 2016. He also said the 2020 presidential election was stolen from Donald Trump. There were too many things on television showing polling places and too many rumors, he said. When I drive around Ohio and other states, I see Trump signs everywhere. There is no way that Joe Biden could have got that many votes. Ahead of the Florida rally, Jack Brill, chair of the Republican Party of Sarasota County, Florida, told Reuters news agency he hoped Donald Trump would galvanize supporters ahead of the midterm elections and a gubernatorial race in which a prominent Trump supporter, Ron DeSantis, will seek a second term in office. Significant numbers of Republican voters see Ron DeSantis as an appealing option for 2024. The 42-year-old has been at the fore in Republican-led fights against anti-coronavirus lockdowns, racial justice protests, and expanded ballot access. In a straw poll on potential 2024 candidates, at a conservative conference in Denver, Colorado in June, Ron DeSantis finished ahead of Donald Trump, 74% to 71%. Ron DeSantis' office has said he's focused on winning re-election in Florida. Ron DeSantis will not be attending Donald Trump's rally in Sarasota. His office said he planned to spend the weekend in Surfside, where rescuers have spent more than a week searching for survivors in the rubble of a condominium building collapse that killed at least 22 people and left many dozens missing.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16, 2021. People's duty with regard to the elections, participation in the elections, and what kind of participation. All those who seek to perform righteous deeds, barring those who have faith, and do righteous deeds and want to do good deeds should know that participating in the elections is a righteous deed which they can do. Now I am going to mention some of the points I have in mind. The most important point is that elections show people's presence on the scene. What does the people's presence on the scene mean? It means that the Islamic Republic enjoys public support. This has a unique effect on the strength of the system of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the power of the country. This shows that no other means or things bring as much power as people's participation does. Yes, we consider military, political, and economic means to be source of power for the country, but none of these bring power to the country as much as people's participation does. The people's participation makes the Islamic Republic strong in the real sense of the word.
Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah.
Well, those who speak fallaciously about the elections, and you can see that in some of the statements they make in the newspapers and in the internet, with recourse to various false statements when talking about the elections to discourage people from participating in the elections, they truly strive to weaken the system. The foreign enemies who are also opposed to the elections strive to weaken the system. They know that if the people's participation decreases and the country is weakened, they can bring insecurity to the country, expose it to the terrorism, and turn the country into a parade ground for terrorists. These things happen when the country and the people's support of it are weakened. Of course, they do not say this explicitly, but we hear different words about this in their statements, and we can see that they strive to do this. They want the people's participation to be less so that the system will be weakened and so that they can throw the country into disorder, to be able to interfere and to turn the country into a parade ground for their mercenaries. One can see this.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. To Allah.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The founding of two North American neighboring countries, Canada and the U.S., has everything to do with genocide and erasure of indigenous presence, as well as erasure of the horrors committed by white supremacist authorities in government, police, religious institutions, and educational systems, says Siku Alulu, writer, in an article published under the heading, Canada's Indigenous Genocide is Ongoing. Stay tuned for more. The recovery of mass and unmarked graves at former Indian residential school sites in recent weeks has released a deluge of outrage and grief across the settler colony known as Canada. Horrifying truths are being unearthed that reveal the treachery by which Canadian governments, churches, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP, originally stole and continue to steal indigenous lands. We say recoveries because these are not new discoveries. This particular form of genocide unleashed against indigenous children has been aggressively instituted and actively concealed by Canadian governments, churches, and RCMP since 1831, when the first residential school was established in Brantford, Ontario. Genocide here is defined both as murders of children and criminal acts of negligence and mistreatment that caused deaths that could have been prevented if authorities had acted on the concerns that were repeatedly brought to government. The high death rates, inhospitable conditions, and preventable causes of death were known. It was not secret, even beyond the stories from survivors and all we heard during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, TRC, states Anishinaabe filmmaker Lisa Jackson, referring to a national commission that took place in 2008 in a recent social media post. It was known by the government, known by the churches, and to some degree, known by the Canadian public. We cannot pretend this is a revelation. That would also be hiding the truth. This is a reckoning of generations of criminal wrongdoing and widespread complicity in this brutal system, unquote. None of what we say here is news. Rather, it is the culmination of urgent messages that Indigenous peoples have been shouting for years across the country and the globe in myriad ways, in perpetuity. I find myself frustrated with words at this point. Tuscarora writer Alicia Elliott tells people because they so often take the place of action in this country. These are recoveries of people's loved ones who never made it home. The truth that were always suppressed and denied. The anguish that makes sense of their lives and compounded righteous rage. It is fitting that the national holidays of Canada Day and Independence Day in the U.S. were preceded by this stark opportunity for citizens to finally see the truth of their countries. The founding of these two North American neighboring countries has everything to do with genocide and erasure of Indigenous presence, as well as erasure of the horrors committed by white supremacist authorities in government, police, religious institutions, and educational systems. James Baldwin described this willful amnesia in the context of slavery and anti-black racism as a sinister crime, rendering white citizens ignorant of both self-knowledge and the systematic violence that they personally reinforce. Genocide and erasure are the origins and continued modes of operation of these countries. Clearing the land for white settlement was enacted by police and government officials through the deliberate spread of smallpox in British Columbia, for example. Railroads built by Chinese laborers, many of whom were indentured, forged paths for white settlers through the provinces and shore up the country. Starvation tactics were used in the prairies to thin Indigenous populations, weaken resistance, force them onto reserves, and signed treaties in which the rights entitled to the land were officially extinguished. Erasure of Indigenous presence through the Indian Act and reserve system, building cities and extractive resource projects over sacred homelands, sterilizing women and kidnapping children are just some examples of how this settler nation was built. After we shake off the emotional petrification and a spiritual shock, we recenter ourselves in understanding that not even horror writers can come up with something as sickening and culturally destructive as the realities the Indigenous nations are coming to terms with now. And over recent years since TRC reports were published, Mohawk Tuscarora poet, media producer, and artist Janet Rogers shares these notes. They say, the truth is more disgusting than fiction, and it was all brought here from over there. Indigenous voices are urgently asserting that colonial genocide and erasure are far from over. Although the schools, or as many are more accurately calling internment camps, officially closed in 1996, we continue to exist within a genocidal society superimposed upon Indigenous homelands that targets women and children at unconscionable rates. Canada's aggressive institution of indigenous youth genocide carries on to this day in the accelerated form of the foster care system that breaks apart indigenous families and apprehends children at higher rates than residential schools, redistributing them in mostly non-indigenous families and away from their communities. It also carries on in the federal government's refusal to cease discriminating against and violating the human rights of children by obstructing immediate access to health care and other needed resources, despite direct rulings by the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal in 2016 and 19 non-compliance orders issued since then. The institution of genocide persists in the crushing ongoing crisis of Indigenous and especially Inuit youth suicide. If it were to happen in these overwhelming numbers in any non-Indigenous community in Canada, it would be considered an absolute emergency, states Inuk writer and performer Instuk Makri. This is an emergency and it is falling on unwilling hearts, unquote. Genocide persists in the racist Canadian healthcare system that enables widespread negligence and malpractice at the expense of Indigenous lives. It persists in the extinguishment clauses that remain central to modern-day treaties with federal, provincial, and territorial governments. It persists in governments' failure to officially recognize Indigenous languages or ensure access to fresh drinking water or adequate housing. It persists and a rampant systematic racism within the RCMP. This national police force was established in 1873 to suppress Indigenous peoples, forcibly settle and relocate people to reserves and other remote locations, enforce the Indian Act, and of course, kidnap Indigenous children. Genocide persists in the arrest and criminalization of Indigenous land protectors enacting responsibilities to sources of life in the homelands. The historic erasure and fierce protection of institutionalized white crimes against humanity is finally coming to light. The callous failure to notify thousands of Indigenous families of these deaths. Mass destruction of records. Continual withholding of records. Refusal to disclose names of perpetrators. The obstruction of any accountability or justice. Colonizers bury the truth of their horrific crimes with the bodies of the precious children in this land in mass grave sites that were never meant to be found without gravestones, without ceremony, humanity, or remorse. At least in the earth, they could be held and in some way returned to creation. The deliberate effort to make these mass grave sites appear invisible, like an ordinary open field, is a perfect example of Canadian nationalism. Institutionalized racism and white supremacy have been so extensively normalized as to be invisible and even trivial to most Canadians. The ongoing violence and, yes, genocide that make way